towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. We take these sacred syllables from the mouth and blow them into the hand. We see that there as light, and we use that to pour over and through our being, this gesture. So take your hands and lift them, and then let them go over your auric field. So today, the subject is the relationship between willpower and God power. And I'm going to get to that, and I'm going to illustrate it with a story about St. Patrick, since this is St. Patrick's Day. You notice I'm wearing my green. I would really be remiss if I didn't mention this great saint. I don't know if you know, but I'm going to ask you, did you know that St. Patrick's was a 5th century Romano-British Christian missionary? My grandmother always said, who's from Italy, you know St. Patrick's Italian. So here it says Romano-British Christian missionary. And he was the Bishop of Ireland. And did you also know that according to his own autobiography, which I believe was written in Italian or Latin, it seems like that title's there, but the English is The Confession of Patrick. When he was 16, he was captured by Irish pirates. And he was living in Britain, and he was taken into Ireland into slavery. There he worked as a shepherd, and he was outdoors, and he was isolated from other people. He was lonely and he was afraid, and so prayer became his companion, and he became more and more attuned through nature and through his prayer to God, we could say. Well, Patrick, as I said, lived for 6 years, and he did escape and he returned to Britain. When he was there, he received this dream. And in the dream, the story is a couple different ways. In one dream, you'll say an angel delivered a letter to him, and then the other one would just call it a revelatory dream, that an angel appeared to him. But he was given this letter, which I kind of like that approach, asking him, beseeching him to come back to Ireland to teach the faith. And not only that, but we hear those tales of driving the snakes out of Ireland. So he entertained the demons. So he had some special powers, you might say. It was also said that he raised, they counted them, interestingly enough, 33, they said men, maybe there were women amongst them, from the dead. So he had very special qualities, like Jesus, in a way. So, but can you imagine how difficult that might have been for Patrick to receive this, a mission from God, you could say, to go back to Ireland where he had, you know, been captured and lived as a slave. But nonetheless, he took up religious studies, and he studied for 15 years before he was ordained. And then he went back to Ireland. And I think, I mean, I put myself sometimes in the place of those, you know, I was raised Catholic, so I always heard the stories of the Christians that were sacrificed for their faith. And I think how St. Patrick had this such great faith and reliance to surrender to God's will, which is part of the subject for today. And it couldn't have been easy for him to return, but he did nonetheless. And this he did by aligning his personal will to God's will, which we'll talk about today. Patrick, his birthday in a sense that his birthday of his return to God is today. He died on March 17th in the year 1416. Now those of you, because I know some of my people, my friends, spiritual friends, and perhaps some of yours as well, Moinadine, I see you have Tonkas around you. There is a uncanny parallel between this mission that St. Patrick did to Padmasambhava, going back to going into Tibet. Bhagwan Sambhava, Guru Rinpoche, lived in India. And also Guru Rinpoche drove out the demons, the snakes. And so there are, if you're interested, do a little research. And then what does this also show us? It shows us that these great beings perhaps return again and again in different forms, in different times, perhaps representing different religions. And of course, this is the path of Sufism, to discover that, to see that, to feel that, to raise above the distinctions and differences, to see that there is a core unity that runs through all religions. And so that's, those of you that are new, I would like to also let you know that. And it, I think it's an important thing to state. So St. Patrick is said to have had this breastplate, and on it was engraved this prayer. It's a very long prayer, so I'm only going to say a few words, but it will show you the aspect of surrender and understanding that uniting one's own personal will with God's will, the power of that, because what he accomplished in his lifetime through his great faith. The prayer goes like this. I arise today through God's strength to pilot me, God's might to uphold me, God's wisdom to guide me, God's eye to look before me, God's ear to hear me, God's word to speak for me, God's hand to guard me, God's way to lie before me, God's shield to protect me. Short, short prayer. And I'm online, you know, if you're subscribed, and I think Moinadine can circulate this as well, this prayer will be within the study guide. So, you know, if that's something that interests you, you could kind of, you know, pirate that and use it as a short prayer every day. I think it's a powerful one and a beautiful one. And I should also mention that, and some of you know, Murshid Maryam Baker, she has a very keen interest in the whirling dervishes, or we should say Jalaluddin Rumi. Some of you know his, most Sufis know his poetry, but some of the newcomers probably do as well. And she's shared with me a prayer that's so very similar to this that it is said that Jalaluddin Rumi said every day. So again, these things transcend time, space, religion. Okay. Excuse me, I'm going to take a little sip of tea. I got a tickle right before we started. So I also will mention a person's name. His name is Hazarat, or his name is Anayat Khan. We use the word Hazarat before that because it's an honorific term for someone that was a great teacher, but that has passed into the other world. So according to Hazarat, Anayat is his first name, Khan is his last name. Willpower is not power, but it is all the power there is. All the power there is. How did God create the world? By will. Therefore, what we call willpower in us is in reality God power. A power that increases, listen, a power that increases by recognizing its potentiality and proves to be the greatest phenomenon in life. Okay, I'm going to read that again because I think that's key. I could probably stop class here if you really take this in. God power, a power that increases by our recognizing the potentiality and proves to be the greatest phenomenon in life. Anayat Khan, who I also call Murshid, which means most senior teacher, Murshid goes on to say, if there's any secret behind the mystery of the world of phenomena that can be learned, it is willpower. It is by willpower that all we do physically and mentally is accomplished. Everything we do comes from that. It is not the body that makes us stand up. It is our willpower. I think I'll stand up and go into the other room. Will. It's not the strength of the body that makes me, you, us, move about. It is willpower that is holding the body and making it go. Man has been able to accomplish tremendous things by willpower. Success and failure are its phenomena. Success and failure are its phenomena. It is only the phenomena of will that brings one to success. And when will fails, however qualified and intelligent the person is, the person fails. I don't think that that's meant to bring shame upon anyone, but it is an insightful statement that allows one to, as Murshida Vira would tell me, pull one up by their bootstraps, take an account, and see if something is lacking in one's own will and in the connection to divine will, which I'll talk more about in a bit. They're truly one and the same, but sometimes we lose the circuit connection. I'll go back and read that statement again. It is only the phenomena of will that brings one to success, and when one fails, however qualified and intelligent the person is, the person fails. Therefore, it is not a human power, it is divine power in us. Anayat Khan goes on to say, now coming to the question of what willpower is made of, in poetic words, he's going to explain it from different points of view. In poetic words, willpower is love. In metaphysical terms, love is willpower. So it goes back and forth, one and the same. One coin, two sides. If one says God is love, this means that God is will. I mean, think what you've accomplished in your life through the power of love. Love for another person. Love for children, love for your profession, love for your home, love for your friends, love for your community. It's a powerful, powerful, willful action in our lives. If one says God is love, this means God is will. The love of God manifests after creation, but the will of God caused the creation. So the most original aspect of love is will. So let's look at this, the will of God. In the Holy Quran we read, we said, it doesn't say I said. In the Quran often you'll hear that in plural, like there's this unitive voice in the universe. We said be, and it became. This is the key to the world of phenomena. This phenomenon does not only belong to the origins of things, but it also belongs to the whole being of things, commanding, be, and it became. We find this same teaching in the Holy Bible, in Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and you know how that goes on, bit by bit. The will of God. One of my teachers, Pir Vilayat Anayat Khan, the son of Hazrat Anayat Khan, would often say, God created us and all of creation so that God could see and feel and know him, herself. That it was an act of love. It was act of birthing us as a reflection of that love. It's so beautiful. It was the will. So I'd like to work with the practice here, but I have a little caveat. If you're not ready for your life to change big time, don't do this very often. We'll do it a few times today, see how it feels. If it feels like something you'd like to take up, check with your initiator. If you're one of my students, you can take it up. You determine for yourself how fast you want to go. You can check in with me. But this is a practice that was given to me by my Murshida, my teacher, Murshida Vira, my first teacher. And it was at a time in life where my profession was blooming, my work with the Sufi order was blooming, I was being very productive. And yet, you know, sometimes you just look around and you say, what's it all about? Is this all? So I was feeling a kind of longing, maybe as if I was wandering in my journey in life, and she gave me this practice. And I can so vividly remember doing it. I had been working with Sharif Graham, a dear friend of many of ours that recently passed away, beautiful soul. I'd been working with him at another very old senior Sufi. Her name was Arifa Miller. And Arifa had invited me to the abode prior to a retreat we were all going to do there with Pir Vilayat. And I was sleeping on her couch. She had a nice big room there. She lived there. And I remember being on that couch and remember looking out her window and doing this practice. It was like this vivid moment, and I knew something shifted. So just be mindful. It's a beautiful practice. It will help get you on the course of your life in a way that you can't imagine. So the practice is kun, K-U-N is the word, K-U-N. Maybe Gemma, you could write this in the chat for us. K-U-N, next word, Bismillah. And I'll spell that, B-I-S-M-A-L-L-A. What do these words mean and why do we say them in these languages? It's like Om, sacred Om. It's like Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. These words, it's like Yahweh. These words have been said for thousands upon thousands of years, and they contain these root syllables that activate centers in our body like English cannot. Now, English has been empowered by certain people like Hazrat Anayat Khan. He taught in English, although it wasn't his root language. Mahatma Gandhi, Sri Aurobindo, they were trying to bring this power into this English language. But the power that resides in these more ancient languages, it's like we ride this current all the way back to the first utterance of that word, those syllables. And what happens? They ride back to us with all the power of every single man, woman, and child that ever said these. And we attune to that vibration in the universe. Okay, so while the words sound unusual to us, there's a great power in saying them that way. Plus, it's very pithy. What I learned from my studies in Tibetan Buddhism is if you say, Gate Gate Par Gate Parsam Gate Bodhisvaha, this means gone. I'm gone. I'm gone beyond. I'm going beyond. I wish to go beyond. The beyond. But it is the pithy manifestation of volumes and volumes of teaching on the Prajnaparamita, which is the teaching on wisdom, wisdom of the mind. So this is another thing. So kun means the act of manifesting, existing or being. That's kun. It's referred to in the Quran by saying the originator, meaning God, of heaven and earth. When God decrees a matter, God only has to say be or kun, and it is. So this is what we're invoking, this kun. So take a moment and just think, what is God manifesting through me? Some people are in times of transition. Some people are going into retirement or just come out of it. Some people have moved. Some people are changing jobs. Some people are, you know, changing relationships. There's all this stuff that's happening with all of us. But what's the purpose in it? And what's manifesting through me? Because I don't think these things happen by accident. And although they may bring pain, confusion, they also bring openness and they create a new purpose in our lives. And I believe with my whole heart that God is directing those things through our lives. Okay. And even if those things aren't happening, perhaps you feel, are things static? Are things stagnated? Is there a little boredom? This can help activate your purpose to further realize it in life. So by asking ourselves that, just putting the question in the universe and in our heart. And if you don't know, as we do the practice, just let this kun sort of set up a vibration within. It'll open you to the providence of your purpose here on earth. Now, Bismillah is wordy, so it says, Bismillah means, in the name of God, the merciful and compassion. So instead of saying something is manifesting through existing and being in the name of God of mercy and compassion, we're going to say, Kun Bismillah. Got it? Okay, so saying Bismillah, let's talk about that too. Bismillah is also an invitation. Bismillah. When I was in Turkey and Morocco, I can't tell you how many times people began a sentence with Bismillah. All the time. They'd open a bottle of water to serve you, Bismillah. They pour the tea, Bismillah. It's like a beginning. It's a beginning. And you know what? I've, in my life, taken that up. I cross the threshold of my door sometimes. I just think, Bismillah, or I'm leaving the premises where we live, Bismillah. When I was teaching, I inevitably, when I crossed the threshold of that door, I said, silently, Bismillah. Or when I left my car and I was climbing the stairs to my classroom, Bismillah. It's a good practice. Try it, try it, try it, try it. It's beautiful. Bismillah, again, is an invitation, and it's welcoming the blessing and the help of God. Not my will, thy will. Not my personal will, God's will. I welcome the blessings of God into my life. And the help of God to bless our every thought, word, and deed. Yeah, that's a good one. There's a great story. I don't know if it was Shams or maybe Moinuddin knows, but there was a murid of a student, a Sufi student of Hazrat Anayat Khan, who was driving him in California when he'd come to the United States to teach. And I think this person probably liked to smoke a little bit too much, drink a little bit too much, and gamble a little bit too much. And of course they could behave when they were in front of his teacher, Anayat Khan. But he said to Anayat Khan, I have a concern when you leave how I will behave. And Anayat Khan said, well, I'm always here with you. You have to know that I'm standing right next to you. And whatever you do, you're doing before me. So it's kind of that way that we're doing this with God to bless our every thought, word, and deed, Bismillah. It's an intention of commencing each task. I take a step, Bismillah. However insignificant or minor, I'm making a meal for my family, Bismillah, with the remembrance of God, seeking God's guidance and blessing. Richard Samuel Lewis always said, the cook and the prophet are one, Bismillah. Okay. So let's do this practice together. And we'll just do it 33 times. We're going to do first aloud. And then we're going to whisper it. We're going to feel it closer to us and more alive within. And then we're just going to go silent and let it, just listen to it within our being. Okay? So we begin. Kun Bismillah. Kun Bismillah, 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 Kun Bismillah. Now 11 times whispering, as if you're whispering in the ear of the most intimate friend. Kun Bismillah. And let the ah at the end, because it's A-H at the end, so let that aspiration continue. Kun Bismillah. Kun Bismillah. Kun Bismillah. silently. You could use one phrase on the inhalation and one on the exhalation. Kun Bismillah. Hasrana Naik Khan goes on to say in this teaching, and that I should say these are teachings drawn from several sources on the same subject. Again, those are listed at the bottom of this document, which is always posted as a PDF on the website. Murshid says, we're apt to look at this whole creation as a mechanism, and we do not stop to think how the mechanism can exist without an engineer, of course, the engineer being God. What is mechanism? It is only an expression of the will of the engineer. And in this instance, in this context, we're speaking of God, who, for the convenience, made the mechanism. But we do not see the engineer, or at least I would say we don't think we see the engineer, because in one of our prayers it says, allow me to recognize thee in all thy holy names and forms. And that is, everything is holy. Everything is. It's an illusion if it doesn't appear to be so. And in people, that's when people are exercising their personal will against God's will. Think of that. I mean, we're not doormats, and we're not like puppets waiting to be activated. We have to do something, but make that the prayer. Make that the prayer. By today, may I be powered by the will of God. May it move through me. Show me the way. I say that often. I will say that personally, I'll tell you. I say that almost every day. I'm not afraid of hard work, but show me the way. I'll do the work. It's like that. We're not just limp ragdolls, somebody waiting for someone to pick us up. No, I'm a worker. I'm willing to do the work, God, but show me the way. Let me align with thy will. Okay, back to this. But as we do not see the engineer before us, and only see the mechanism, we involve ourselves in the laws of the working of this mechanism, and we forget the engineer, by whose command this whole mechanism, this whole world, is going on. How did it happen? What do you think the Big Bang is? Who struck that match? The scientists that I know in my life are some of the most spiritual beings. When I taught at the college, they'd line up to come to the meditation class. And if you're at all attuned to the new physics, it's in their language as well. I mean, science is mapping on to the great spirituality of the world. So it's there, and we know it's there. So I'm going on with Murshid's teachings. A part of that will we inherit as our own divine heritage. Oh my God, think of that. A part of that will, capital W, we inherit as our own divine heritage. And it is our consciousness of that which makes it greater. And it is our consciousness of that divine will, that spark within our souls, that consciousness makes it greater. Now listen, please listen. This paragraph's also, in a nutshell, so important. It is the optimistic attitude towards life that develops the will. You remember I've told you my favorite book as a child was The Little Red Engine That Could. And that little red engine, all those big locomotives were going by. But that little red engine kept trying to get up that hill. I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. Then pretty soon, I know I can, I know I can. It is the optimistic attitude towards life that develops the will. The pessimistic attitude reduces it. It robs it of its great power. Oh, I don't know. I don't think I can do that. I'm not going to be able to do it. I will be no good at that. Why should I even try then? I mean, think of it. It's in us, but we have to kind of activate it. Okay. Therefore, if there's anything that hinders our progress in life, it's our own selves. Now, I know that some of us fall. You know, I've had depression in my life. Thank God it's momentary. But I've also known people that I've had to tell them, this isn't quite right. You need to go talk to someone. And so if you're feeling what Murshid is saying, more pessimistic, like, oh, what's the use? Oh, I don't want to even try or whatever. Go talk to someone, you know, a minister, a priest, a teacher, a therapist. We don't have to live like that. Okay. So I understand that. Just seek some solace somewhere and don't feel bad if you don't have these feelings right now. We all go through our ups and downs, but I'm not trying to shame anyone, and I know an icon wasn't, but he's trying to give solid advice to us. Okay. So therefore, if there's anything that hinders our progress in life, it's our own selves. It is proven 1,000 times over that there's no one in the world who could be our own worst enemy to us than ourselves. For at every failure, we would see ourselves standing in our own light. And so, you know, I remember it happened in Assisi, Italy. I saw it for the second time. The first time I saw it, I was in Switzerland. They grow these fields, huge fields of sunflowers. And maybe, Gemma, you've seen it there in Kansas. And those sunflowers are just standing so tall with their faces up to the sky. And as the sun moves, they start to move their little heads around. They're always facing the sun. And so Murshid says here, it's the failure of ourselves because we're standing in our own light. It's because we have our back to the light and there's a shadow before us. If the shadow's before us, we can't see that maybe there's a crack or a step there and we could trip and falter. No, turn towards the light. Turn towards the light. Let the radiance come in. I feel like I'm a Baptist preacher today. I've got some juice going. I hope you feel it. I hope it's coming through. The earth holds the seed, and the result is that the plant springs out and bears fruit. And so it is with the heart. The heart holds the seed of thought, and there also a plant springs out and brings the fulfillment, the fruit of fulfillment. Now, I got to tell you another little story. I always do these little sidebars, but I'm checking the time here. Some of you know me very well, and you know that I had established in 1996-97 a foundation to help Tibetan refugees. I'd been living in India, and I saw the journey that people were making to try to find freedom out of occupied Tibet, occupied by the Chinese government. And, they came into such a life of poverty. It was just unbelievable, what they had endured frequently in prison because they wanted to dare say the word Om, or they wanted to have a picture of their spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. I met them. I've talked to them. Some of them have testified before the UN Commission on Human Rights, but many of them didn't get that opportunity, so there are a few spokespeople. I can't even tell you. It can literally make me weep, and I do. But I carried the stories of many, and I said, I can't just keep. Why am I learning about this? God, help me. So what did I do? I started circumambulating the Dalai Lama's temple. And there's a place there where there are these beautiful statues. Their prayer was every day. I'd stop every day. And I'd say, please, if I have the capacity to do something, please help me know what it is. And if I don't, please don't harden my heart, but uproot what I'm learning and seeing and feeling here. And you know what? We created a foundation called Gompse Sokpa. So I go to my Rinpoche, who was one of the teachers. He was the Tantric master for the Dalai Lama. They were very close. And I was very privileged to study under his care and live in his monastery. And I said, Rinpoche, I have this idea. I want to do something to help. I'd like to create a sponsorship program and maybe find other ways to raise money to bring back here to help. And he said, it's a very good idea. And I said, but how? He said, you plant the seed, just like here. The heart holds the seed of thought, and also the plant springs out and brings fulfillment of fruit. Or the fruit of fulfillment. And he said, plant it in your heart. Pray. You may not even know the direction or how it's going to happen. Just keep it there. And don't let the hope die. And you know, we ended up sponsoring hundreds upon hundreds of refugees. We built a school so that they could learn English. We published textbooks for the monks in the monasteries. We solar powered the Dalai Lama's monastery. Oh God, what, I don't know what else we did. We did so many things. And the people, we never took any money. I always paid my, for my own trips to India. I didn't take any money. We weren't paid. Gemma was helpful. She was kind of the secretary. Joe was the treasurer. And there were a lot of people in India that wanted to help us. Merchants, they'd say, I know what you're doing. I said, don't tell everyone because I can't help everybody and do only a little bit. We want to help you with giving you merchandise at a very cheap price from our shops. These were shopkeepers that were settled. And you go sell it and make money. So we would do that. We would transform our home into a Tibetan bazaar to raise money. And that's how we did these other projects outside of sponsorship. But sponsorship was set up just so that the money could go directly to the refugees. They were educating themselves. They were starting little businesses. And they were developing these deep, loving relationships with their sponsors, who sometimes they came to see, the sponsors had them come to see, or the sponsors went to India. So this is the power of prayer and putting that seed. How was I going to do that? My God, I had a full-time job as a professor, but I still did it, and I had help from a few friends. Anything is possible. And I had such a great trust and belief in my teacher that he told me to do that. It manifested. So please don't ever think anything's impossible. With the power of God, hope and faith in your heart, anything can happen. So Murshid goes on to say, the mind is like a restive horse. God, do we know that? We try to sit in meditation and pretty soon, you know, it starts jumping around like a monkey or a wild horse in this instance. Bring a wild horse and yoke it to a carriage, and it is such a strange experience, for the horse will kick and jump and run and try to destroy the carriage. So it is with the weight of the mind. To carry, when you make it, take one thought and hold it for a while, but it's so important. It is then that the mind becomes restless because it's not accustomed to discipline, and all the more so in our day than it was in Murshid's when he, you know, passed away in 1927. Started teaching in 1921 or 22. You know, I mean, there weren't TVs, there weren't phones. I mean, it's constantly, even since I've been on this call, people are texting me. It's coming through on my watch. You know, it's always there pulling us. So we have to grow accustomed to this discipline. Unplug and breathe and keep a thought before us. So important. I'm friends with Pir Shabda Khan, and I was friends with Murshid Wali Ali. And I remember one day we were at a retreat together. And then they were leading, and among other leaders of their organization. And they came to me and they said, you have your computer? And I said, yeah. They said, can you make a circle and a dot? And I said, yeah, what do you do? This was Murshid Samuel Lewis gave his students that concentration, a circle with a dot in it. And they did a breath practice with it. That's how they developed concentration. And the breath practice was towards the one with the dot. Breathing in, yeah, and united with all, breathing out. So it taught them everything comes from the singular point and everything is united. Everything returns to that singular point. Everything manifests from that. So that was a good way to keep the eyes focused. You know that if you've worked with healing at all in the healing order of the Sufis. Keeping the eyes still helps with concentration. I do especially. I'm very visual, so my eyes move around. I have to make, and that's why when we meditate, especially in traditional Buddhist meditation, we cast the glance down the tip of the nose and keep it focused because it helps focus the mind. Okay. Where am I? So it is a weight for the mind to carry when you make it take one thought and hold it for a while. It is then that the mind becomes restless, and it because it's unaccustomed to discipline. There is a thought that the mind will hold by itself. Are you ready to hear this? Because I think this is pretty interesting. It's the thought of disappointment. We go over it and over it and over it. Of pain. Oh, pain, whether it's in our emotions or in our body. Grief. I'm so sad. We all know this. I know this. I have to pull myself out of it. Sorrow and failure. It's a natural tendency. And Mersha talks about that being as a line in the mind, a groove. He likens it to a, you know, what happens when you get the cars stuck in the mud and you just keep spinning your wheels? That's what the mind does. It keeps going over it. And you have to force yourself to pick up that needle and move it, or that get someone to help you lift the car out of it and move it. We have to try to grab our mind and move it. In Tibetan Buddhism, we talk about things as antidotes. So if one's feeling, well, it works with the six perfections. That's complex. I could go on and on and on. But well, if we have pain, what we do is we think about all the other beings that are feeling pain, and we willingly sort of draw in that pain of suffering, and we send out love and light and comfort. That's a kind of antidote. But while we're sending out that light and love and comfort, what happens is we also receive that. So that's a transformation. That's part of when people say tantric, that's tantric. It's a transformation of the lower kind of emotions. So enough being said. You want more on that? I'll give a class on that. The mind will hold it so fast that it cannot take it away from the grip, and the mind holds it to itself. Again, these negative thoughts, they can just keep rolling around, and it's so hard to snap ourselves out of it, but we have to. One of the things that I do, one of the Lojan sayings in Tibetan Buddhism is do something different. So I get in the car and I go somewhere else, or I take a walk, or I go look at a beautiful tree, or, you know, when I was in Kansas City, I would go to the museum a lot. It was convenient for me. Or this other place that had beautiful statues. It was called Van Loo and fountains. And I would just go walk around to look at beautiful things. Beauty is an antidote. In Sufism, we say towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty. So looking at something beautiful, reading beautiful poetry, listening to beautiful music, these things are antidotes to these things. It helps to lift the veil from of these other other emotions for us. So I have just a little bit more and one more practice, and I think I'm gonna fit it all in. If I don't at 10 and you need to go, I would understand. When once the mind is disciplined by concentration, by the power of will, then the mind becomes our servant. Once the mind has become our servant, then what more can we wish for? Then your world is your own. You are the king or queen of your own kingdom and queendom. So concentration. Focus. Anayat Khan goes on to say, discipline has a place in life. We don't always like it. We want to feel free. We don't discipline, but self-discipline, we know this as Sufis because we do it for ourselves. However difficult and tyrannical to us it may seem in the beginning, yet it is that which in the end makes the soul the master of life. And here's the secret. Doing our daily practices is a discipline. Doing the breath practices, the prayers, and the given wazifa or mantra, if you will. This is a discipline. And what's more, if you can create a certain time of day to do them, that's a very good discipline. And many, many times you've heard me say it, those of you that we work together, find a regular time for eating, for exercise, and sleeping. And I'm of the ilk that the earlier you sleep, the better, because I think restorative sleep is truly between like 9 and 12 at night. But and the Dalai Lama, you know, he sleeps only from 9 to 3 in the morning. So that, and you look at how long and he's lived and how much he gives to others. So this kind of, we don't like it. It's like, I like staying up late. That's my time. No, it's good to just try something different. Okay, if it's working for you, keep doing it. If it's not, try something different. Okay, so here's the other practice. It's not part of the sacred names, but it is referred to often in the teachings. And you will find it throughout the Sufi message volumes. Let me take a little sip of water. These are two active principles, and at times they could be considered opposing principles. The words are kaza, and Gemma, maybe you help again. It's a Q-A-Z-A. And the other word is kader, Q-A-D-R. Now, sometimes you'll see it transliterated with a K instead of a Q. So it could be K-A-Z-A and K-A-D-R. Well, what do these mean? These are Sufi terms, and they represent the two aspects of life. Kaza is the unlimited aspect of life. Everything is available to us. As mentioned, Murshid mentioned, the potentiality is there, but are we tuning into it? So that's one aspect. Kaza, unlimited potential. Kaza is the divine force that works through all things. Kaza animates the whole universe, and Kader is the free will of the individual. Kaza, as I mentioned before, Kaza is unlimited and Kader is limited. Okay? So this universal aspect of power and this limited. Now, think about it. It has to become focused, just like the discipline. So this will of God has the potential to focus through each one of us. Okay, the trick is making that connection. Okay, that's why I use that picture of the Sistine Chapel. A little bit more, and then we'll do the practice, and then we're almost done. When the two powers of Kaza, the universal power, and Kader, the individual power are working harmoniously, things come right. But if they clash, that which is thought right by Kaza will happen without regard to what Kader may think right or wrong. So there's this force that's constantly trying to manifest through us. Those who know this and harmonize their will with Kaza, this unlimited aspect, with the universal will, begin to experience divine impulse. And they begin to feel every time what is and what is not harmonious. We get this inkling. It's like, well, that seems like a great idea, or that person seems like they're fun, but I'm not sure. Trust it. It may be that impulse coming through to protect you. If it happens enough times, you will really understand and trust it. One of my guides said that. You may think this is fantasy. You may think it's not true. You may think you're making things up. When it happens one time, two times, three times, maybe. When it happens, starts happening 100 times, you really learn to trust it. So again, it's part of the training. It's part of the training. To such as these, there come fewer failures. To people that can understand and harmonize, there come fewer failures in life, and it becomes easier for them to swim with and not against the tide. Now, you all know that we live at the beach, And there have been, often we get warnings on our weather channel about these riptides. They're very fierce and they really draw you in, you know. And nonetheless, we go out in the water. But what is the antidote, you would say, or what is the way that you cope with it? You cope with it by relaxing. And if you do relax, you come to the surface, and eventually that tide coming in that also pulls you out will deposit you back on the shore. So it's like this, relaxing into the divine will. The other thing is you can sort of swim with the current. It may take you down the shore a bit, but you will eventually come right to the shore. So I'd like to work with these words, and we're going to use as a prefix before these words, Yah, Y-A. And Y is a respectful term. Since these are two powerful forces that work in our lives, we're going to give it respect. And so let's do this 33 times again, 11 aloud, 11 as a whisper, and 11 silently. But what we're going to do is we're going to move our head. We're going to consciously lift our head when we say Kaza, the unlimited, and we're going to start to lower it when we say Kader. And Kader is at the solar plexus area. Could also consider that the deep heart. And then we're going to lift again this Kader, the individuated will, as we say Kaza. We're going to lift it up, and then we're going to bring it Kaza back down to Kader. So it'll look like this. Yakaza, Yakader, Yakaza. Let me think. I'm not sure that's right. Let me feel the energy. It may be Yakader. That's how it's going to be. Yakader, Yakaza, Yakader, Yakaza, Yakader. So lifting this divine will, raising it up to unite with Kaza, and bringing Kaza down to touch that Kader. Is that clear? Yes, okay, good. Thank you for the affirmation. Okay. So we're going to start with Kader, raising it up, and Kaza bringing it down, uniting. And of course, where are these two points united? In the heart. So think of that, and this grows brighter and brighter as we work with the practice. And this is like a pole that's connecting these two wills. Okay. Yakader, Yakaza. Yakader, Yakaza. Yakader, Yakaza. Yakader. Yakaza, Yakader, Yakaza, Yakader, Yakaza, Yakader, Yakaza, Yakader, Yakaza, Yakader, Yakaza. Now just whisper with the name, so it'll be like this. Just silently breathing in, lifting up on the in-breath Kader, and bringing down Kaza on the out-breath, depositing it into your being. Pater in casa. Well, it's a little after 10. Is everyone ready to go, or do you have time for a short story?
Sure, sounds good to me.
Moinadine, a few minutes for a short story?
Oh, sure.
Yay!
Short story.
So this is a story, some of you know, my friend Sri Karunamayi, God rest her soul. And
she'll be here Friday.
Sorry?
She'll be here Friday of this coming week in Phoenix.
But Karunamayi Ma's deceased. It might be a different Ma that's coming.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. She was a trustee of the teachings of Sri Aurobindo, and she was a great music maestro. She wrote and sang beautiful ragas. She was classically trained. She was well-educated and was the they called it vice principal, but it was like the vice president of the School of Liberal Arts in Agra University. And she kind of renounced it all to go to live in an ashram, thinking that she would be able to sing her devotional songs all day and all night. Well, she was able to offer them at night in their temple, but she became an administrator because she had that skill also. So she, like an icon, renounced her music to some extent until she retired. And then people traveled from all over the world to meet her and study with her. And she also traveled the world. And I met her in 1990. So here's the story about human will and divine will. So we were traveling together. We traveled both in the United States and in India. On this occasion, we were in Calcutta. And I don't know if any of you know Sri Ramakrishna. Of course, he's deceased many, many years ago, but he wrote this beautiful text, and it's quite hefty, but it's very illuminating, called The Gospel According to Sri Ramakrishna. And I had been reading that text before I went on this pilgrimage. And it happened, and we were with a group of women, but she and I kind of would split off often, and we just kind of had a very wonderful connection. And such was the case. We arrived in Calcutta, and we had done some work at the missions of Mother Teresa. And this evening, it was an evening, we were at this most beautiful, exquisite temple complex of Sri Ramakrishna. And the way some of those complexes are built is there's a center courtyard, and on the outside, which is kind of a promenade, and on the outside are small, I don't know how to explain it, they're very small temples, maybe for just one priest and a few people to sit in, and offerings are made, you know, in those. And so we had come from the main temple, which was very big, and it had a statue of Sri Ramakrishna, and they were fanning it with peacock feathers and chanting. And it was, sometimes it can get quite active. And so we were seeking some solitude, and we walked out. It was a beautiful evening. It just seemed sort of perfect moment. And just as we came upon a rather large, but not taller than us, place in the center of this very large courtyard, everything, it was like this stilling moment, you know, like you see that in movies. And all of a sudden, all these, as if someone was taking a robe full of beautiful jasmine flowers, began to descend upon us, and the air was filled with jasmine flowers. And Karunaji, as she often would, she'd go, "Oh, pay attention, pay attention. We are united with the universal will. Everything is in harmony in this moment." And then she read, because it was in Sanskrit and Hindi, that the very place we had stopped was the place where Sri Ramakrishna had received his enlightenment. how did that happen? In quite a violent way, apparently. His teacher, Sri Lukteswar, there was a shard of glass on the ground. And you know, you hear about those stories of the Zen master that slaps you with a stick to kind of startle you and wake you up from slumber. Well, in this instance, as the story goes, Sri Lukteswar picked up this shard of glass and he jabbed it into the third eye of Sri Ramakrishna. And at that moment, he opened to the universe and received his enlightenment. Well, nothing quite that dramatic happened to me, but what I do know happened was Karunaji, she became like Sri Lukteswar. She grabbed the back of my head and she poked her finger as hard as she could, as if she was going to go through the back of my head, right in my third eye. Now, I can't say that anything really happened, although it felt like such a blessed moment and there was a moment of light. But, you know, it was just that moment where everything seemed still, everything, even the loud chanting, seemed to go away. The jasmine flowers and the scent came down upon us, just like this gentle, and it was this perfect moment because we were there where Ramakrishna had received his enlightenment. So that's what I'm talking about. We had been tuning to each other and to the atmosphere of the places we had visited. We had the opportunity to visit many holy people, and it was advantageous having her with us because we saw all those holy people. Otherwise, we would have been in a waiting room getting tea and cookies somewhere. But because of her personality and people knew her, it was an entree into these beautiful meetings with beautiful beings. But yeah, I just wanted to share that because it was just, watch for those moments. There's something gets very still and you notice a leaf fall in a particular way. Take it in, you know, or there's a particular sound or a scent all of a sudden that comes in. These are special moments. Let them be blessings that fill your being for remembrance. I do believe that these are things that, you know, they live in our soul. And I feel that as we're leaving this earth, these memories flood us and come back to us to help uplift us. So let them do that for you. Shall we close with a prayer? We will say this prayer of Anayak Kant's, that he says each line is a living metaphysical reality. It's called Ketum. O thou who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear thy voice, which constantly cometh from within. Disclose to us thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness. Teach us thy loving forgiveness. Raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide.